Everyone, this is Opinion Science, the show about the science of our opinions, where they come from, and how we talk about them. I'm Andy Luttrell. I'm getting right to the point today. This is the last of the episodes coming out in the wake of our podcast series on behavioral economics. If you don't know what behavioral economics is, well, good news. We made a podcast about it. It's called They Thought We Were Ridiculous, and you can find it on the Opinion Science podcast feed. It came out in February. There are 5 episodes. You'll find it. I produced it with the very lovely team at the show Behavioral Grooves, and it took a very long time, so please listen to it if you haven't already. You'll hear from a truly all-star cast of social scientists as we tell the story of how some bold academics pushed back on the key assumptions of their field and ended up making a real mark on the world. And for me, the real climax of the story is in the 4th episode, when their decades of research ended up seeping into how governments think about policy. Imagine noticing some weird quirks in a theory as a grad student, and years later you're consulting with national governments, because that's what happened. One of the people we talked to was David Halpern, who helped usher behavioral science into the British government through the Behavioral Insights Team, or BIT for short. He makes some appearances in the Behavioral Economics series, but I've always really enjoyed the conversation we had with him. And he has interesting things to say about the value of social science for public policy in general, and how academic and government institutions work together. Or don't. Whatever the case may be. By the way, David wrote a really great book that I read while prepping to talk with him. It's called Inside the Nudge Unit: How Small Changes Can Make a Big Difference. It's a little bit about how the Behavioral Insights team came to be, but it's mostly about the interesting results of their massive experiments, applying behavioral science ideas at scale to see if they work. And a lot of them do. One of the guiding frameworks in the book is the EAST framework, E-A-S-T, which is that if you want to encourage people to adopt some behavior, you should make it easy, attractive, social, and timely. Anyhow, just as I shared the full interviews we did with Sendhil Molanathan and Daniel Kahneman, the final interview I want to share in full is this one with David Halpern. It's mostly he and I talking, but you'll also occasionally hear from Tim Houlihan, one of the Behavioral Grooves co-hosts. So let's jump right in to our conversation with David Halpern. So we'll be curious to get your take on the story of how the Behavioral Insights team came to be, and then also just sort of more abstract insights on the role of behavioral science and policy. Does that sound good?
Sounds really cool. You know, by the way, it didn't start in 2010. We had a full storm when I worked for Tony Blair to try and do it a long time ago. If I remember literally sitting, talking to Danny Kahneman about it in Admiralty Arch before he had his Nobel Prize, which tells you how long ago that was.
So yeah, 2001. So anyway, So it seemed like, yeah, so you made the move to government earlier than 2010. So if we sort of go rewind all the way back to the beginning of the story, could you describe kind of where you were before you made a jump to government work, when you were an academic sort of peddling the typical...
I can, Andy. I used to be a respectable academic. That's right. I had lifetime tenure at Cambridge. What was I doing? And back in... I'd known Tony Blair a little bit before the 97 election, but particularly what happened is as he won a second term in 2001, he wanted to strengthen number 10 in Britain, Downing Street, and particularly wanted to create a stronger so-called strategy unit. So I agreed to come in on loan from Cambridge for 18 months from 2001. I ended up actually working with him for 6 years until Tony went. So I did a long stint in that period. But it's relevant to behavioral science because we did have some early goes at trying to introduce these ideas. There was me, a psychologist, and I'd written on, you know, trying to apply psychology to policy, and then suddenly I'm in the strategy unit, and it was all very exciting. And we wrote a paper on behavior change, as it was called, personal responsibility and behavior change. Anyway, it totally tanked. And it went down politically very, very badly. And we talk more about that. But essentially, there was these sort of full storms trying to move forward behavioral science early on. To me, there were a lot of lessons about how you had to get the politics of it right as well. So that when I slightly unexpectedly found myself being asked to come back to Downing Street in 2010 for David Cameron, it was like, you know, let's get it right this time. Let's not screw it up, which I think we did generally.
Could you be a little more concrete about in what ways it tanked and you ran into these issues? Sure. Like, what does that mean exactly?
So there's always been these issues, particularly around nanny state. And It hit a particular bump, which is still relevant and terrifies politicians across the world today, which is that one of the things in this paper, we explore different kinds of instruments that influence behavior, including using prices and price signals. And we floated it. It was like, I don't know, 60, 70 page paper. That one line reference to, you know, basically, you know, food and particularly fat taxes. And would they be relevant? As it actually went on to conclude, actually, they probably weren't the best tool right there and then. But it, nonetheless, I remember coming into the strategy unit, that the Prime Minister's strategy unit that morning, and it was already all over the front pages of the Times saying, Prime Minister's strategy unit proposes fat tax. And there was a kind of full-scale meltdown in the kind of press office, like, what have you guys done? What is this about? Because it was just a discussion paper. It wasn't a so-called policy paper. But it led to a sort of overreaction in the system, and it has a deeper roots, which is that Tony Blair was, as a prime minister, often used legislation and regulations of various kinds, and he was interested in behavior. He was interested in getting parents to make sure their kids turned up in school. He was, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We often would use legislation. So it was already seen as a quite a heavy interventionist government. And then, oh my God, you guys want to do this as well? So it played quite badly to an underlying critique of nanny state, and led to a sort of bit of a kind of full-scale retreat, including it was running up to conference season, and essentially the Prime Minister saying, of course, we'd never do any of this sort of stuff. Now, as it happens, we did do some things. We did do some things, particularly, for example, on changing defaults. The early work was done right back then on pensions. But nonetheless, it didn't become a mainstream program. It didn't fit with the political narrative. And in fact, actively, as you see, had sort of run into the sand in a quite spectacular way. I always remember going down Whitehall that day thinking it was, you know, because the Department of Health was literally on the phone at one point saying, you know, we weren't briefed on this, but actually we are quite interested in some of these ideas. Can you please not kill them? And number 10 press office saying, are you guys mad? What are you doing? We need to put out a statement saying, we never do any of this stuff. And then going out to try and get some peace and quiet down Whitehall. And there was this kind of Whitehall cafe. We get a sandwich, and they literally, where they normally put out, you know, on those, you know, tuna or whatever is options. And they'd written, get your sandwich now with butter before the fat tax comes. Somebody had written. So you really know, like, oh my God, if the cafe are already writing it, right. This is a serious storm and it's going to be bumpy. So it does really matter. And it does matter also when you see when Obama picks it up later and Cameron picks it up later. It's probably not a coincidence, particularly in the UK, that it was a centre-right administration. And in some ways, it was juxtaposed politically as being an alternative to regulation. That's probably overstated, but that helps to get you away from this notion of it's just the state getting ever bigger. So Cameron literally was using it politically as part of the argument that time around how in some ways do you reduce the size of the state by using these kinds of techniques. Of course, that can get you into different political issues, but yes, a long history. And so actually, I remember talking to Danny Kahneman in 2001 about, you know, what would be the applications. But I remember Danny literally saying to Danny about, so what else have you seen which you think might be policy implication? And he's saying, well, actually, there's this kind of slightly obscure paper by this bloke called Richard Thaler talking about, you know, save more tomorrow. And it's like, oh, great, we'll look it up. And I remember literally, so we look, I've actually visited a really, really neat piece of work and sending it to Adair Turner, who was just starting a literary review on pensions. So there are all these kind of complicated routes behind the scenes that these things sneak in through.
So when you said you were interested in policy from the jump as an academic, was that always sort of in your sights as you sort of were coming up through the ranks there?
I guess so. I've always been a slightly weird academic in Cambridge, you know, kind of combination of tolerated and frowned, you know, odd. Why would you be interested in these questions? I've always been interested from long ago in how could you use scholarship and methods and evidence to try and figure out, make the world a better place. In fact, many years ago, you know, I was a Natsky, a natural scientist originally, and I was going to go and do architecture and planning. My father was an architect and planner and had a place actually to do it in the US as a second degree. But it really bugged me that, you know, we would knock down all these buildings and then put up something new. And like, why were they any better? It seemed to me, why isn't that an empirical question to try and figure out how does a physical design influence behavior, and that some way might shape what you do, be it building a single building or a whole city. So I ended up like not going into architecture and then doing a PhD on, well, what's the effects on behavior and mental states and whatever of the physical environment. So I've always been interested in that, and I actually spent a while in what was called the Policy Studies Institute before kind of coming back to academia, Oxford, Harvard, and then Cambridge to try and say, well, why can't we use social sciences, psychology more broadly to figure out, you know, I realize it's slightly wonkish, but, you know, can't we scratch our heads and figure out what's a better way of running an education system or a healthcare system? So, yeah, I was always interested in it, which is partly why I actually already knew Blair a bit from before the 97 election. And, you know, I love academia and I love academics and scholarship and the world of ideas, but it's just, you know, it's going to say, well, so what? Well, what does it mean for everybody else out there? And because behavioral science very squarely has sat in that territory. It's essentially taking a lot of psychology and saying, well, so what? Well, how does that help us live healthily or happily or save money better or whatever? For what it's worth, I also think it's intellectually very challenging because your theories then are really tested. You know, it's like genuinely out of the laboratory. And, well, if you do this thing, does it lead to the consequences in the real world that you think? And if not, maybe your theory is wrong and you need to tune it. So I don't buy the argument that, you know, there's a sort of hard divide between the academy and policy world. When you do it well, they are very strongly mutually reinforcing. It's intellectually incredibly challenging, you know, as well as challenging of your theories. It really hothouses them to see if, are they right or not.
Yeah, there's this, I keep coming into this divide between basic and applied research. And, you know, so much of kind of the elite academic institutions that do basic research sort of turn their noses up at applied work. But more and more, it seems like a lot of good theory work is done at the application phase, right? To see when push comes to shove, does the model actually predict anything and create the kind of change that we're expecting? I've been enjoying the book, and in it, you refer to yourself as a recovering academic, and it made me wonder, are you recovered, number one? Have you fully recovered since you wrote the book? And then also, would you consider going back, or does this seem like, no, this is the world where the work matters more?
Well, I tell you, I mean, I have kind of moved backwards and forwards. So it was this period, so I worked for a few years in somewhere called the Policy Studies Institute. And then I was quite frustrated by the fact that the work we were doing there, you know, the agenda was set externally, and we often weren't asking the most interesting questions because of how the commissions would come in directed research. And that moment of realization, well, if I went to Nuffield, I was very lucky I had a prize research fellowship. And, you know, it's like a kind of 19th century vicarage. You can just do good works and choose your topics. And so academia gives you incredible freedom to explore issues, ideas. And, you know, if you can retain some line of sight to the so what, I mean, it's a wonderful space to be in. So sure, yeah, there are times when I think, God, it would be nice, and, you know, I get to enjoy occasionally reading books and papers and, you know, try and work out what's, you know, really cool coming up in the field and we should be learning about. And of course, there are times when I kind of miss that world of ideas, and when you want to dig in deeper and work out, well, what is the causal mechanism here and what's going on? And if we understood that better, maybe we could do this more effectively. On the other hand, when summer comes around and I remember marking for 2 weeks solid, and I'm like, maybe I don't miss that bit.
So what was that first time that you brought an idea into the public sphere to test it in public policy?
So that's, by the way, a bigger issue, which is testing. I mean, one of the most important things, in my view, that Behavioral Insights team did, and we did it in London, in Downing Street, more than the White House, for example, originally did, which was, it was a Trojan horse, to some extent, to bringing in randomized controlled trials and stronger empirical methods into government, popularizing them. So you don't have to care about behavioral science to think that that would be a good idea, to be more empirical and test and use literal as well as quasi-experimental techniques. So that's obviously a broader question about where we can drive empiricism. If your question is really, when do we first, those early results using behavioral science alongside a randomized controlled trial, and we got it in like a magic moment. So we did a bundle of them from 2010, and it wasn't that the Prime Minister was saying, can you do them as randomized controlled trials? We just thought it was the right thing to do. We weren't sure that these effects or ideas would translate from a Harvard lab into a real world setting, and certainly in Britain. So and also it was a very, very skeptical audience. Amongst policymakers who are like, oh, it's just a shiny, ridiculous new idea. It'll go away soon enough. So we set up trials, particularly some of the early ones. We did a clutch of them, really. But a particularly powerful one was around tax, people who are late payers of tax. And it was a big battle behind the scenes to get that to happen. There was another one which we produced at a very similar time around essentially people who were in debt, often through the court system, and how could you prompt payment there. And there were a couple of other ones, but probably the tax one is probably in some ways the biggest of all, because it showed such a beautiful, clear result, which across we did run five arms on it, and then was about 8,000 an arm, I think. And we were able to get about a 15% increase in payment rate without further prompts by changing one line in a letter. And that was definitely a kind of wow moment. I can literally remember sharing it with the heads of departments, we call them perm secs in Britain, and them going from sort of chattering like, you know, funny jokers from number 10 into, oh my God, this stuff is actually pretty useful. But and it, remember, it was also important because it was a time in Britain when Britain was also facing very severe financial difficulties and austerity, and government was under real pressure financially. So that's not a trivial matter to say, you can have one line, and this was just in inverted commas on a block of 600 million of late paid tax, and you get that kind of scale of improvement. And you could just almost feel the room turn as that graph comes up when they realize this is something which actually seems to work and might be useful.
Even a 2-3% increase would be, at that scale, like an amazing improvement. But to get that, I mean, that was a real win in terms of...
Yeah, it was a big effect size. I should say it was a percent as opposed to percentage points. So it was more like half that or, you know, or something in percentage points. But nonetheless, massive. Yes, absolutely massive. It also was really important. So there were considerable battles involved in getting our tax authorities to agree to running a randomized controlled trial. It was very, very controversial internally. You could monetize it relatively simply. And of course, that in turn has led to a massive body of work in many countries trying to work that out. By the way, a lovely detail which also helped in the follow through is that we also looked at complaints, and complaints fell coinciding with as these kind of techniques started to be introduced. Because it's actually just kind of a nicer way in some ways of encouraging people to pay tax. Say your fellow citizen is more virtuous than you thought they were, as opposed to threatening to take away your TV or whatever. So that was interesting and again helped, I think, to reinforce the shift.
That people are open to it. Not only is it effective, but it's going to roll out relatively seamlessly with the public.
Yeah, it's a less offensive rude letter to get. You know, it's a sort of a polite prompt. And as you'll know, it also relates, we now know that you get these systematic overestimation of bad behavior in the public in many countries where we've looked at it. So it's itself a nice intervention, as I said, to kind of remind people that your fellow citizens are more virtuous in this case because they're paying their tax faster than you think they are. And that result, of course, actually replicated in many places. For example, Guatemala, we did a very similar study in Guatemala. And we thought, well, it'll never work in Guatemala because they have, you know, very low so-called tax morale. And that you definitely could not claim that, you know, 9 out of 10 people paid their tax on time. But even in Guatemala, we said to people, you know, 62% of people pay this tax. Everyone was like, oh my God, 62%? Are you kidding? Really? That many? And it was a similar effect size, actually larger.
Did you have an inclination before you started that people were going to be more virtuous than they were behaving?
Well, we obviously knew the wider literature around social norms, and going back to Chialdini's wonderful work on littering, etc. You know, we are very influenced by these. I think it was certainly later than that that some of the system. We actually did some polling ourselves, working with Ipsos Mori and others, looking at a number of behaviours, asking people, you know, do you do these things? Do you take a sickie off work, etc. And how many other people do you think do this? And you see these kind of gaps again and again and again, particularly around bad behavior. Sadly, not for good behavior. People don't seem to overestimate good behavior. So, I mean, we obviously had good grounds to think, you know, if you reinforce and just let people see what the prevalent so-called declarative norm is as opposed to the injunctive norm, we had good grounds to think it would work. But I think later work has shown this other sort of effect that runs alongside it, which reinforces why it's a pretty sensible thing to do.
When so I think this was at a time when you had given yourselves an ultimatum where if we don't produce results, we're going to just shut it all down, which I'm curious, when you set that up, in your heart of hearts, did you believe that you would actually like keep the thing running? Like you'd produce enough insights that it would still run? Or did you truly think like, no, we're, this thing once the time's up, this thing is over?
I really wasn't sure. I mean, remember, I'd already done 6 years in the Blair administration at Number 10. So coming back, and I'd also in between set up something with Lord Sainsbury called the Institute for Government. We're trying to make government work better. And so I was very aware of governments, certainly in Britain, but many other countries, create these kind of units and teams, which they don't really figure out if they work or not. And they kind of carry on like a dried up twig on the family tree of government. It's a semi-quote Blondie. And, you know, why wouldn't you shut these things down? So we just felt it was a good discipline, certainly put it that way, blame on other people, that why not shift the default and say that if this thing doesn't deliver, then shut it down. And by the way, shut it down early enough in your parliamentary cycle so that by the time you get to the next election, it was a distant memory if it didn't work. And it would just be a good discipline. It would also force us to really move it to see, does this thing work or not? Remember, the corollary is that if it did work, you know, you'd proven it, and it would be like, okay, well, so let's do it properly. How would you scale it? How would you move it forward? So yeah, it was kind of, I guess, relatively daring. It was a range of, it wasn't the only thing that was kind of a number of innovative, if you like, policy leads that were being pursued in Downing Street at the time, some of which I was responsible for. So the work on well-being, the measurement program on happiness, for example, that was pretty radical at its time too, still is. Some of what was so-called big society. So there were a number of things that were going on. And in many ways, what's interesting, I think, is that if you had to take a guess of which of those were going to succeed and which of them were well-resourced, the behavioral insights team was definitely not going to be top of your pile. It wasn't given very, very much resource. It was a slightly kooky idea. So, set it up with a sunset clause. And then, as you know, oh my God, it does work. And so the decision to not shut it down was powerful. And itself became a powerful secondary signal in government, right? Because it was an active decision. Oh my God, this stuff does work. You know, let's get serious. What's the next? How do we take it to scale?
Could we back up just a second and talk about where in the 2010 iteration of this, how it started? So like the story of where the idea came from, who had the idea, why did it even seem possible that this social science could inform government to the point that we'd go, yeah, let's go find some people to try it.
So there were a few things that were floating around. And to dig into the detail, you're right to prompt, is that there was a proposal which was put out externally. So if, even at the tail end of the previous administration, there were some internal supporters. So there was the then cabinet secretary, a guy called Gus O'Donnell, became quite interested in behavioral science. Remember that there'd also been the financial crash, where lots of the conventional economic models had sort of blown up, and particularly, well, we'll go into the detail, but because of the actual market behavior and with human beings, and a lot of people were surprised. And it was quite a profound challenge to some of those economic orthodoxies. And that's why people like Lord O'Donnell, Gus O'Donnell, became interested and supportive. So even in the tail end of the Labour administration, there was interest thinking there's something here which we need to unpack and we should revisit these ideas. I was at that time at the Institute for Government. And so we did a joint report with the British Cabinet Office looking at behavioral science and what was its implications, and what was known as the Mindspace report, which itself was a mnemonic. You might remember that. So that was actually done before 2010. So as it were, you know, a lot of the preparatory work was being done around the scenes, but then that coincided with some of the people around David Cameron who were looking for interesting new ideas. So these things come together quite powerfully. There was a guy, Steve Hilton, another guy called Rohan Silver, both advisors to the, who would go on to become the Prime Minister and the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And as I said, they were interested also in deregulation. What's an alternative to regulation? And if you want to stop doing something, you kind of need an alternative. So these kind of came together in terms of a political narrative, relatively edgy, some administrative support, such as people like Lord O'Donnell, and some external stuff saying, actually, this is pretty sensible and we've done the work before. Indeed, I remember flying to Washington to talk to Cass in the White House or the Eisenhower building before the 2010 election to say, actually, what do we learn from you? Again, just sort of preparing it so that if this moment happened, we'd be ready to move. I might just say on a personal level, I did also write possibly a slightly pretentious book, but before the 2010 election, about 2009, called The Hidden Wealth of Nations, which was and it had this bit at the back of it, which was a kind of reflection from, you know, if you were prime minister, here's 10 things you should do, partly drawn from the Blair years, some of the things that didn't happen in the Brown years. And one of them was basically, you know, get serious about behavioral science, which Steve Hilton and others have picked up on. So, you know, it was just a number of things that were coming together in Britain, which created this moment, which gave us both kind of, if you like, academic interest, the literature kind of coming together, administrative support and political support that made it a runner.
You mentioned talking to Danny Kahneman, and of course, just flying to Washington to see Cass Sunstein. But what was your first interaction with Kahneman like, and under what circumstances did that happen?
Well, I, of course, knew Danny's work from, you know, centuries ago when I was an undergraduate. And I remember, I can still remember as an undergraduate actually reading, you know, his 73 and 74 papers on, you know, heuristics and biases. And it just stood out then. It's like, oh, this is so neat. It's so powerful, this mapping of these heuristics. And, you know, one of those really exciting moments as a young person where you find a piece of knowledge, and this is, you know, 1980s, of course, so it'd already been around for a while, but it wasn't widely talked about. But it just, to me, it always stood out as an incredibly powerful body of tools. So yes, I can't even remember why Danny was around, and I must have been emailing with him, whatever, to come in and talk to us. And it was then, as I said, the strategy unit, as it was called, and Jeff Mulgan and I sat with him, and we had this wonderful conversation. So, I mean, Danny's a really interesting figure, and of course, in subsequent years after his Nobel Prize, and you know, much, much later in the Cameron administration, I remember Danny would occasionally have in to do a seminar. Danny himself has never been very interested in policy questions. You know, so he would actually be quite frustrating in that way. I remember in number 10, after he'd been much more famous later on, and everybody was very excited because Danny Kahneman was in the building and we're all lining up and say, so what should we do on this and what should we do on that? And he'd sort of shrug his shoulders and say, well, look, I'm just a psychologist. I do stuff on cognition. What do I know about what you can do with your healthcare system? So, but obviously just a monumental, you know, figure and one of those key bridges. You know, the layering, of course, of prospect theory and all the rest of it. But, you know, Danny wouldn't claim to be a policy person. I think he's pleased that people pick up with it and run. His main thing is he didn't want The Economist to have all the credit. I think he's been pretty public about that. He finds that, why do you guys keep calling behavioral economics? It's psychology. And incidentally, that did actually affect what we called the team when we set it up in 2010. Because, you know, we could call it a behavioral economics, you know, team. And we knew it would really annoy Danny and a number of other psychologists. And so that's why we ended up with this slightly strange term, the behavioral insights team, because we wanted to emphasize that we wanted to draw from many academic disciplines, certainly psychology, anthropology, as well as economics. So I'm sure Danny whispering in our ear would reinforce that, you know, don't call it economics. We were also, by the way, I mean, Danny's interest evolved into, as you'll know, issues around well-being as well. And so we were doing that at the same time. So we were also talking to Danny about that in 2010.
Well, my impression is that the term behavioral science is fairly new. I mean, as a social psychologist who sort of keeps seeing the work that we do fall under this behavioral science umbrella, that feels to me like a fairly recent thing. Was that a term that was floating around when you were starting this work? Or do we blame you for the rise?
It definitely was. I mean, literally, in terms of the unit, we did think relatively, one of the, should we call it behavioral science, you know, unit. But as soon as it would inevitably be initials in government, you know, it being the BS team was not going to help our cause, since people already thought that we were a bit, you know, on the edge. I think, Andy, of course, you're right. It's become quite widely used. It's quite striking. A lot of academic colleagues I notice now use these terms, behavioral science and so on. It has a sort of fashion and power to it, as opposed to being a plain old psychologist or a social psychologist or something. But at least maybe it does play the role of it blurs the boundaries between disciplines. And since, you know, history and philosophy of science, a lot of that story is around, it's the interstices between disciplines where some of the richest thinking occurs. So if it helps that, I don't know if you feel that in your experiences, but if it helps bring a few wider disciplines together, not too worried about, you know, what they're called to think about a problem, bring it on.
I think it also just has no baggage, right? It was invented out of nothing as a term, behavioral science, whereas people have some assumptions about what psychology means and you're manipulating and treating me. And economics has, you know, the economy has baggage in terms of the term. But behavioral science just kind of is this nice, clean, not loaded with any assumptions that people can just go, oh, yeah, that totally makes sense.
I think it's also helped another way. I mean, there are lots of battles which, you know, as a half full, we've come a long way, that are definitely not finished. I find it very, very striking if you look in your average kind of industrialized country, when you look at these science budgets, what does that mean? It's very, very dominated by, you know, places where you know, molecular biology, people in white coats, that's proper science. And then if you actually look at the spend on the whole bucket of you might call behavioral science, economic psychology, it is a tiny, tiny fraction of what we spend on big, proper science, you know. And that's particularly strange given if you look at the shape of our economies. So our economies to somewhere like Britain, right, is 80% services. You know, it's massive. It's literally public services, a third of it. It's not for the most part that we produce, you know, a new kind of widget that produces economic growth. So one of the really big arguments, which is behavioral science, you know, plus, 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 is why can't we use good rigorous methods to figure out better ways of, you know, teaching our kids or improving population health or reducing crime or improving the productivity of our economy or our workers or increasing well-being? You know, these, I think what often happens, I literally had a conversation recently with a very, well, I won't say who it is, but a Nobel Prize winning scientist who, as soon as he got to these, he said, well, those are just, they're social and political issues. You know, they're not, that's not a science issue. And I'm like, wait a minute, why can't we use good methods to unpack those kinds of questions too? And when you look at it, they're like, the world is full of them. So there's this quite deep imbalance. And maybe behavioral science does create a useful bridge between those perspectives, because it helps to get in people's mind that actually these are questions which are amenable to scientific method to figure out why do people do that and what could you do differently. By the way, COVID, of course, the most recent illustration of it as to, but has the penny dropped? I don't know. You tell me.
Where is BIT headed? How much of a global enterprise can you imagine with bringing behavioral science to policy throughout the world?
Well, I do feel, you know, not just BIT, but, you know, sister teams and units elsewhere, you know, I've got a lot to be proud of, but I also think there's loads of things where we haven't hardly begun around, we touched on some of them, you know, public health issues, for example, save the planet. That'd be quite a good idea, wouldn't it? Looks like it's got some quite strong behavioral components. Conflict and war, you know, those two wars typically start in a year. We've done a tiny bit in that area, but that looks a lot like human beings falling out with each other. So in terms of the issues, but also their global, you know, reach and perspective, a lot of policy issues are inherently global. You know, it can be climate change on the one hand, but it can also be things like antimicrobial resistance. You know, you can't really crack antimicrobial resistance unless you stop putting so much antibiotics into the food chain across the world. So it's right and proper. We also took the view, back in 2013, 2014, we were getting a lot of requests from other governments and other parts of the world who were interested in what we were doing. And the normal thing would have been to say, sorry, you know, we're really busy, or maybe we'll see you for half an hour. But it was like, well, why don't we engage? Why don't we help? Why don't we actually roll up our sleeves and try and help with these problems? It would also mean that we would learn a lot, as well as, you know, the UK is 1% of the world's population or whatever. What about the other 99%? Why don't we get out there and help? And so we already, that was partly what drove changing the Behavioral Insight team to move it out from inside government to turn it into a social purpose company, still co-owned by British government, actually. But you asked about what next. Well, it follows from that there's a lot of other issues to take on. I feel like we're still just scratching the surface. I think Michael Hallsworth will probably say the same in relation to many, many areas and many issues. You know, what we should be impatient and restless and try and say, well, you know, what can we do in those other areas? What does that mean for the Behavioral Insights team and other institutions? Well, you know, it's not perfect. We can always be better. We're very aware of becoming much more global, I think, overtly in our orientation. We do stuff in South Asia, but nowhere near enough. You know, if you want to take on climate change, we need to be working with India, right? We need to be working in Latin America. You want to take on conflict, there's lots of bits of the world we need to get to. It also brings in its wake, by the way, quite interesting theoretical and empirical questions. I'm a very big fan of Joe Henrich's work. In fact, we have him in later this week on weird psychology. A lot of the things we've done, we have found do transfer, but it feels like that's not good enough. It's hard to understand the story of Afghanistan without thinking, was there something about weird psychology which was imposed on a strategy there, which wasn't right? You know, or work on corruption in different countries and places. So we ought to also be revisiting our psychology in an underpinning sense and say, you know, what do we need to do upgrades on to understand this better as we go global and take on some of these other challenges? So, look, there's no shortage of challenges, sadly, perhaps in the world. But it's also an exciting time. I mean, using data science, more experimental methods becoming, if not fashionable, at least starting to work its way into different parts of the system. It's an exciting time to be a young researcher who might be interested in making the world a better place, whether you come to BIT or somewhere else. Bring it on.
Nice. I know we only have a few more minutes with you. And one of the things that we want to emphasize in the series is highlight ways in which behavioral economics have informed just like the ways that certain things work in people's lives. So the pension being like default pensions being one like very major example of this. And I wondered if there's anything else that comes to mind. You know, we're trying to keep the focus a little bit on behavioral economics as, you know, itself and its contributions as a specific form of behavioral science. So I don't know if anything comes to mind for you. One of the things that I was really taken by in the book was the My Data initiative, which seems like, I think that's how you would pronounce it. Is that what you say, My Data? Data, which sort of confronts what economists would say, well, people should just be like monitoring how much things cost and how much energy they're using and making decisions based on that. And your team said, well, maybe we need to make it easier for them. So I don't know if that strikes you as a good example of behavioral economics in action. You can sort of walk us through what that was, or if something else stands out as like, no, this is my go-to example of behavioral economics making a real change in people's lives.
Well, so for behavioral economics specifically, as opposed to the broader agenda, so financial behavior, of course, there are famous examples, defaults on pensions, which we all know and love, but further evolutions of that. To us, there's a much bigger set of questions, which are broader, you might think of around so-called behaviorally based market failures, which are really important to understand and a key frontier area. So there's a sort of presumption in a number of governments, particularly center-right governments, but actually in general, which is the best thing actually government can do is sort of get out of the way and let the market do its thing. And conventional competition policy doesn't quite capture the range of these issues or failures. So My Data, which was spelt with an MI because someone had already, I think, copyrighted the MY version of it when we were writing the act, it was a part of that story, and the White House, incidentally, was doing in the U.S. Treasury some quite similar work at the time. If we can give consumers access to their own data, then you can kind of flip the world upside down, away from just companies doing consumer management to consumers being able to do vendor management. And that's still quite a big idea. There were quite severe limitations to our earlier applications of it, partly because of political resistance, which we can talk about if you want to, but it was the start of something, I think, which is important and still continues. It's not that most individuals will literally use their download of all their shopping spend or their financial spend, but it means that it kind of licenses intermediaries who can work on your behalf to figure out what's the best deal and product. So this is still itself My Data, I think, part of this bigger idea, which is how do you make markets work? And in particular, how can you not just kind of reduce those failures, but on the one hand, like unpack what is preference? You know, what is your preference in the moment when you're on social media and spending another however long versus when you separate yourself from the phone for a few minutes? You seem to make different preference, let alone collectively make different choices. So, you know, the expression of preference itself turns out to be quite an interesting thing. But when you hit a lot of markets, as people like Labson have talked about, you get these so-called shrouding problems, would be the simplest illustration. So you can see one attribute, price, normally, but you can't see some other attribute. Like you're choosing a care home for your mother, you can maybe see how much it costs, but you can't really see a really good quality measure. There's not a sort of trip advisor in most countries for a care home. This is true in lots of areas. It's true in relation to climate change. You know, you can. It's very hard often to see what's the real kind of carbon footprint of a given product or which supermarket is greener than another. So you have these so-called shrouding problems, which means markets compete on one dimension and not another. So this is an absolutely key area for behavioral science. And I think one of the big dangers for the field is that people get stuck in thinking it's all about quite specific narrow nudges around an individual, whereas quite often the biggest, most important changes is using behavioral science to understand how markets operate and to intervene in much more sophisticated ways. So as I said, most obviously, where you move enough marginal consumers, perhaps by deshrouding, that it changes the whole market equilibrium. And I don't know how many people would think of that as behavioral science. Most people wouldn't think of it as nudging, but it's an incredibly important area with a lot to give, actually.
And yeah, you mentioned the political issues, and I noticed one of the things in the book you mentioned in working with the tax department and the sort of eye rolling that they did when you walk in and say, hey, I'd love to ask you to implement this randomized controlled trial in the things that you send to people. Do you have any, you know, advice for people who are getting into this world and have to navigate political and logistical bureaucracy?
Well, I do. And actually, Michael Holdsworth, who you mentioned earlier, was literally the person. In fact, we kind of did the deal because the department was so horrified about this idea, you know, and the legal advice was, it's, you know, it's probably illegal and you shouldn't do it. And literally, the head of the department might end up in jail if you do these kind of things. I mean, literally, that was kind of the advice was given internally. It's hard to believe. And let alone the mechanics of the system weren't set up to do it. So we actually partly did the deal by saying, actually, I tell you what, if we find a good young researcher, why don't you employ them directly inside your department? You can keep all the data, you can never leave, right? And then if it's a real disaster, by the way, you can blame us, but whatever. So we had to do all those things to kind of get those early ones across. But even forget the behavioral science, the idea of doing experimentation is still very, you know, radical and almost an unthinkable, actually, in relation to some fields. And so my belief, as you may know, I spend a day a week still as national advisor on what works, which is basically championing more empirical methods and more empirical institutions, a lot of which is better empirical methods. And so there are some examples where it's kind of moved from zero to hero. I would say in Britain, something called the Educational Endowment Foundation has been running experiments in schools with kids. Oh my God, we're running experiments on kids. Well, yes, because we quite like to figure out a better way that they might learn maths and English and all the rest of it. And you know, the world didn't end. So I think there's often this kind of reaction, which is somehow unethical to run a trial, but people tend to not think about the counter, you know, factual, which is, but you think it's ethical to do this intervention on millions of people or kids without testing if it's effective? It's incredible that that's not considered unethical, and yet the trial is. I think that the deeper barrier is that it's, you know, it's overconfidence. So often, oh my goodness, we hear, you know, someone will say, but we know what works. It's like, are you really sure you know what works? Because you've been doing that thing for years and most of the kids don't die, doesn't mean there's not a better way of doing it. And indeed, maybe the thing you're doing isn't having any effect at all because you've never actually tested it. So that's very, very tough to, essentially what you're doing is you're saying embrace humility, embrace this, you know, possibility there might be a better way of doing it. To make it easier, I think the thing to do is of course to say not just test everything from scratch, but say, is there a variation on what you're already doing which might be better? And a lot of innovation and improvements occur at the margin. You know, let's not underestimate the importance of marginal improvements. Like that's where a lot of, you know, productivity growth and gains occur. So trying to get people excited about that, to see also lots of aspects of systems which they might not have thought of as being subject to experimentation or innovation. You know, literally the way that you say something to a teenager might be consequential. Well, could we test it and figure out the right or wrong way of saying something to a teenager? Is itself quite an exciting agenda for many people who are more frontline workers or professionals, that if they've got it in their hands to do something which is better and to essentially become a more empirical profession. So if you look across fields, they're in very, very different state. I think education is now starting to move forward, criminal justice system a little bit, welfare a little bit, but not very much. You know, when you open your eyes to it, you realize that there are just massive tracks of what we do in government and in society, which we've never really actually tested to see if they're effective. And that's a very exciting flip side to it. You say, oh my God, imagine if we start being empirical about these things. You know, what should be possible? The scale of improvement when you start bringing these methods into new domains, and the scale of improvement, which itself then is really consequential for, like, literally the trajectory of a child's life, you know, or how long we get to live, or, you know, wow. You know, we're kind of trying to bring the Enlightenment back to life and into new areas that it never went before, bring the scientific method in. So I realize I drifted a bit, but, you know, I think to try and bring in some excitement of just what that means when you say run an experiment or test, about, you know, it's the key to the universe, empiricism, right? So, yeah, it's pretty exciting. And I hope we'll look back at it in future generations, often say, and think, oh my God, you mean you didn't used to do this? How weird is that? I think there will come a point where people will really have got there, and we'll look back on this period and think it's very strange that we did all these things where just someone thought it was a good idea, maybe ran a focus group, and it was never tested. But, you know, it's still important to help people make that transition. But the last bit of advice I tend to give people is, you know, don't try the biggest, most controversial issue. Try something small. Run a small experiment on some interesting detail. Like, almost, what are the questions in your mind? What are the things where you've wondered, you know, maybe I could have done that, but I didn't do that. Like, can I go back to that? Maybe that would have worked better. And just start of kind of get into the habit and run some smaller experiment or intervention to kind of get into the habit of it. And once you start doing that, it's like, well, if it worked for that and the world didn't end, why don't I try it on this thing and this thing and this thing? And I think generally people then kind of catch the bug.
Well, that is a very inspiring note to end on. I know you have to run, and so I just want to say thanks for taking the time to talk about this. This was super great.
Not at all, Andy. It's really, really good. I'm sorry my answers have been ridiculously long.
They've been fantastic. It's great to get a little bit of David Halpern's utopia here this morning as well.
Yeah, well, I do. I mean, obviously, again, I do kind of believe it. I think I'm so aware of how far we've got to go with not just behavioral science, but the application of empirical methods into government and policy and all the problems and challenges that lie around us. And wouldn't it be good to have a bit of excitement? And if we can divert a few people from a lifetime in a library to think actually they could take on this thing. I mean, I just say one last thing. I often say to people when they join BIT, you asked about kind of some of my early career, you know, as an academic and then move into the different domain. I hope that you're kind of a younger generation. Andy, you're probably in that generation, actually, now I look at you. You won't have to choose. Why can't you be a brilliant social scientist, thinking interesting things, writing the occasional paper, and be a kind of person who's trying to affect change in the world? Like, you know, as opposed to have to choose, shall I become go into the world of politics or policy? Let alone be a social entrepreneur. That means trying some new things. And what's really cool is there are these sort of spaces, like in place like BIT, where you get to do all those things at once. Like, you really think about cutting edge behavioral science, good methods, apply to real world policy problems, and try and be entrepreneurial and inventive to try and find new solutions. So that's a pretty cool kind of new space to be in, which hopefully many of your listeners are in. And, you know, come on in, the water's warm.
Well, we will encourage everyone to do exactly that. Thanks again, right, David, for taking the time to talk.
Very good. Good luck with it. Glad you're doing it. Okay. See ya.
Thank you so much to David Halpern for taking the time to talk about his work and experience. You can find links in the show notes to learn more about him and the Behavioral Insights team, which has evolved into its own company with offices truly all over the world. His book again is called Inside the Nudge Unit: How Small Changes Can Make a Big Difference. Since he spoke about the psychologist Daniel Kahneman quite a bit, I suppose it's also worth noting that we talked to David in 2021 before Kahneman's passing. For more about this show, you can go to opinionsciencepodcast.com, follow us on the hip socials, subscribe on all the podcast platforms. We're coming back to regular Opinion Science programming from here on out. So I'll see you in a couple weeks for more Opinion Science. Bye-bye.